You are listening to episode 122 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, 30 years of computer-aided analytics. If you ever wanted to, say, work for Adobe or a tech company, you might have to do an interview.
It's true.
And they might ask you some weird questions. And so Glassdoor recently shared some of the most oddball job interview questions that were asked. And some of them are pretty interesting. So, like, for example, Airbnb, company we've talked about many times, think of it as Uber for your home. Usually they say it the other way around. But one of their interview questions, I feel like this one, how lucky are you and why?
That's an interesting question. How lucky am I? I would usually go with quite unlucky. I would be forced to do a statistical analysis on it, and I would say that that's an interesting question. Do you want me to answer it right now? Do we have time for that? Okay, now I'm thinking about it. Because my gut instinct has always been to say I'm rather unlucky because I don't win contests. I don't win, drawings. I don't win that sort of thing. To the effect of I do not play. Like when somebody comes around and says, do you want to do $5 for this raffle and it goes to a good cause? I always say no because it's not fun for me. It's irritating. I'm not going to win. I do the same thing when I go to, I've spent probably $25 gambling my entire life because I burned through it so fast. I literally won nothing. I didn't win once. And I was playing like quarter slots on $20.
You got to play with Lisa. She's a winner.
Yeah, well.
She went to Vegas and came out ahead by $2.
Oh, baby. Yeah, see, and that's, I just sit there and I go, and I'm fine with that lot in life, but the reality of it is, if you were to really get, dig into how do you define luck in a grander sense, like playing games, I don't really play games, and I'd imagine if you were to really ask the question of what was the likelihood of me winning in those, what were my odds versus how I performed, you'd find that I performed just about as what you'd expect. And I didn't really overwin or I didn't really underwin. So the question I would start to ask is, what about places where there isn't just a raw luck bias in life, but it's an unquantifiable bias, like playing game, like playing, skill-based games that, or what high school I went to. Or how my sports team performed. Things that don't really include me necessarily, they're not entirely based on my skill. There is a large quantity of luck that's involved. How lucky have I gotten? But there is some skill that I've been able to provide to it or decisions that I've made that have led to that. And I'd have to say at that point, that was supposed to be one example.
I related to this. I was watching an NFL football highlight.
That's really funny. Okay, one second. I got so excited with all my hand gestures there, I just broke 1,500 steps for the day on my Fitbit. I gave myself the extra steps. Yeah, sorry.
1,500, huh?
Yeah.
Wow, you really got out there today.
15,000. 15,000, sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. That's different. Like 1,500, dude. Even I got to try to get that low. Anyways. I was watching this NFL highlight thing, and it's the commentators are talking about the players, and this one receiver, he bobbles it or it goes off something, and he gets a crazy bounce, and it just like lands in his arms for 50-yard gain or whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
And one of the commentators goes, "Oh man, he's so lucky," and one of the other guys, he said a really interesting point. He goes, "Isn't it amazing how?" I can't even say it as eloquently as he did, but he was like, essentially, isn't it amazing how all of these great athletes tend to get lucky as well? And, his point being, dude, it's not really luck. These opportunities happen, and they're good enough that they can take advantage of it.
And a lot of times it's he knew where the ball was going to bounce.
It comes across as lucky.
Right.
Yeah, something like that. You know, he had that intuition, could do it. And, you know, I've had stuff like that, and I'm just not as good. And so I just dropped. You know, I was almost unlucky. Oh, I got a bad bounce. He couldn't pull it down or something like that. You know, but these guys, like, they're good enough. It seems lucky, but it's not. But it was just an interesting comment.
Right.
Anyways, so Yahoo has a question. Okay. Theirs is, if you were on an island and could only bring three things, what would you bring?
What's already on the island?
I'd bring a pair of underwear. That's a great question.
It's literally a stupid question without the answer to that, because if it's a deserted island,
it's Hawaiian island?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying, man. Is it like a, you know, is there a hotel? Because then I'm bringing my iPod, my towel, and some swim trunks. Like, what do you want from me? But if it's a deserted, I mean, I guess the implication is that it's a deserted island, and I know I'm going there, and I'm allowed to bring three things. Man, my magic lamp. That's tough. Where is the island? Do I know? I mean, I was able to bring three items with me. Am I aware?
Yeah, that's true. Is this a tropic island or an Arctic island? These
right.
are
is,
questions.
Is it 10 miles from
another? You
know,
maybe that's what they want to know. You know, do you think about that kind of stuff, or do you just make assumptions?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
I hope that's what it was.
How about this one? This one's a little morbid. So ZocDoc, a Google Documents or Drive competitor, essentially. What's your least favorite thing about humanity?
People who eat with their mouths open. No.
Oh, man. But humanity.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Just like, you're like, huh, I don't know. I'm a positive person. I don't think that way.
You see, that's my problem. Is I'm like, okay, I gotta narrow it down to one thing. No, I'm just kidding.
I hate that we waste so many resources. No, I don't know. That one's a tough one. That one's a real tough one.
That is a tough one.
Apples. Yeah. Their question is: if you were a pizza delivery man, how would you benefit from scissors? Even to them, to come up with some oddball question.
Well, I have scissors in my car for all the reasons that I would benefit from scissors. Like, is this the list? Well, I mean, you need to cut stuff all the time. It works as a great tool. It's a general purpose. In a pinch,
screwdriver.
Thank you. I'm holding it up. Nobody can see it. A screwdriver in your car. It's just a general person. It's a knife. It's a, you know, obviously it's a pair of shears. It's a straight edge. It's all sorts of different, like, you know, creative different uses that are obviously going to be useful to anybody that's driving. If I, in particular, for being a pizza man, sometimes I guess you got to cut receipts.
You have a little concern because I have neither of those in my car, so...
Yeah, see, yeah, that's...
I feel like you're the weird one. I'm going to be honest. You're
okay, that's one. Fine. I use all these things in my life. They're...
Okay. Another interesting one is, why is a tennis ball fuzzy? I feel like there's a real answer for that one.
That is a really interesting... Okay, I'm going to Google that. And it'll probably bring me to a Yahoo questions answer.
Oh, how about this one? You'd like this one. If you could sing one song on American Idol, what would it be?
Ooh. I believe I can fly. I don't know.
This one's dumb by Dell. Are you more of a hunter or a gatherer? I feel like that's a sexist question. But I'm not sure. I'm a hunter.
I like
maybe
that.
The Delta like something.
Yeah.
Dumb. That was a Xerox, by the way, who wanted to know if the tennis ball was fuzzy.
Okay, wait a second. There are two parts to this answer. The first is that the original ball was used for early the early predecessor of tennis. Court tennis used a cloth-covered cork, hair, and wool ball. The cloth covering was important, as otherwise the ball was very hard. Rubber didn't start to be used until the late 1800s, and the ball still tended to be hard and fragile as a soft felt cover. So a soft felt cover was used. Plus, tennis balls, being a traditionally rich sport, never really tried to change the look of equipment much. Second, the felt covering also does allow for much more control, like dimples on a golf ball. So no one has proposed a different ball, though other racket sports use non-cloth covered balls successfully. So basically, tradition, which is what my guess would have been if I had made one.
Yeah. To which I'd be like, well, what do you think the original reason was? But you gave that answer. So those are some interview questions of some tech companies. So yeah. Be prepared.
I've always thought those are cool, fun ones. And the two things, the shortcut answer to how to answer all of those questions, if anybody's wondering, is 3 points. Ask more questions about it. Don't make any assumptions. Two, think out loud. Tell them why you're coming up with the answers. And then three, get the answer right. That's really remarkably important sometimes, especially at Google. They're notorious for, they don't want you to come up with an interesting answer. They want you to come up with an interesting and correct answer.
Yes.
So, yes, yeah, that totally is cool. Those are, I find those interesting. I like those sorts of things. Brain teasers. So, there's a Korean carrier. They've launched a new service that will get 300 megabytes per second for your wireless LTE. You're clocking it at two right now on yours. I'm clocking it at about 10. They get 300 on their phones. That's
pretty nice.
You pay like $120 to Comcast a month for business class 100 megabyte hardline data. That's a third of Google Fiber's gigabyte per second. That's unbelievably fast on your cell phone. It's crazy. I basically bring that up because it makes me want to move to Korea. I can't even. The state of the internet in America is terrible.
You should totally do that.
It's a good idea.
Just move to Korea.
Dude, honestly, I'd have the bandwidth to be able to keep doing the show. Come on now.
Sounds like it. That's crazy.
There's also so Google has started banning certain Chrome extensions from the Chrome store because these guys, they basically would go through and you'd make these cool little clever app or clever extensions that don't take extremely long to build for a lot of these people. They get a lot of people downloading them, and then some company would come along and say, hey, I think I like your app. Mind if I buy it from you for what they described as too good to be true prices? And it's like, too good to be true for who? If you're the dude who developed an app in a couple of hours and sold it to another company and got a bunch of money, like, seriously, what do you care? Like, you got a bunch of money for it. But basically what these companies were doing was they were taking already established extensions. They were adding a little bit of code, specifically malicious code designed for ad tracking and, you know, inserting ads into everything. And then pushing that out as an update to an already large user base, which turns out Google was not happy about. So they are now going through and banning a bunch of those apps. As they try to move Chrome forward as a platform, they're trying to make it more and more.
Spam is super annoying, or, you know, this type of spammers. But on the other hand, you're like, dude, that's massively creative.
Yeah.
They've, like, I got an idea. Let's buy something legit, and then we'll just inject code into it. Done.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, and it's
super smart. How do you keep up with that kind of stuff?
Well, and it's funny. I mean, what drives me nuts about it is it's like spam companies come up with this, but it's just a good idea in general. It's basically what Google does. And, you know, they go through and buy giant companies that, like, huge, like, growing companies, and then turn them into something that they can turn into revenue later on. They just don't do it as a spam company. I mean, like, it's a legit business model. You just have these spam companies that are doing it, you know.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah. But weird. And then this is a really interesting article that somebody wrote this week. I'm sure it had to do with the 30-year anniversary of the Mac, which is why it got dredged up, but it's basically this 10-year-old article review from it was called The MP3 Insider, an opinionated take on MP3 and the audio revolution. But it basically was this dude was reviewing the original iPod.
That was funny, you kept saying this dude, and I was like, I'm going to find his name, and it's not on this article.
Huh. At all, yeah, I know.
10 years ago, we didn't care about that stuff.
Exactly. But basically, he's giving the original review of the iPod, and he's complaining about all the things that he complained about originally, which was it only works for the Mac, they've got exclusivity problems, exclusive. It's it lacks compatibility with any operating system other than Mac OS 9.2 and 10.1. Pricey, it's too expensive. Critics have said that it's too much to charge, and when there are perfectly good MP3 players hovering around the $100 mark. But I doubt these fault finders have actually held any of these devices in their hand. If you consider the iPod's design and features, the fact that the hard drive-based players are almost as expensive, $400 is a fair price, which is interesting because I remember that used to be one of the big complaints, and he's basically saying it's not that overpriced. And then people are criticizing it for being bare bones, the lack of bundled accessories like FM stuff, and he's like, it doesn't... You know, whatever. So these are like, I say all this to think it's just interesting kind of retrospective of what they were talking about was complaints of the iPod originally. But he basically comes around and says, this is the beginning of the subtle revolution. And this was the genius of, I personally think that if there was one thing where you could really say this was the genius of Steve Jobs, especially second time around at Apple, this was it. And I remember thinking when I first got my first iPod player, which was years after everybody else had one, I got one of the iPod video ones where it was like a full-blown iPod, but it had a color screen so I could watch videos and stuff on it. I remember just being astounded by the idea of there's a hard drive, all of my data's on it, and I can just ingest the data like there, like on the device. I don't need it on my computer. I can bring it with me and like bring it to other, I can like watch it with other people. I can like put it onto big screens. This is awesome. And basically what this guy was saying was this, where he said, this is the future of computing. The personal computer, it is gonna be completely dwarfed by the iPod and what comes after it. I think it's interesting. I think what's interesting reading here is he was kind of vague about what he predicted, and I think he was kind of more in terms of, I think he was thinking, a lot of people are like, he totally predicted the iPhone. I don't think he really predicted the iPhone so much as he was just like, clearly he got it, which was, okay, there's potential here of this idea of your portable computer that's incredibly portable. And, you know, obviously he wasn't the only one, except he was like, you know, this was like months after the first one was announced. So he was, as far as it goes of figuring out where the trend was going, he was pretty early on in calling this one out. But he, yeah, I don't know.
This final, this last sentence here, he sits there and says, you know, the iPod descendant will include the hard drive and possibly the processor and OS for running a networked PC. You know, and we just call it an operating system, I guess. He goes, there will be no security concerns because each user will be authenticated via possession of the hard drive combined with passwords or biometrics. If a more secure identification technology were added, which turns out it doesn't, the device could even act as some sort of secure digital ID for activities such as boarding planes or filling prescriptions. And, you know, you just, you know, yeah, yep, and a whole lot more.
Yep, yeah, yeah, yeah. He got it. He got it. And, I mean, it's impressive when you think about when the article was published.
Yeah, would you say it was 10 years ago?
Yeah, it was reviewing the first iPod, so it was
I guess that's right.
2001.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Probably pre-9/11, back when we still cared about these sorts of things.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird. This is getting pretty far off the rails, but it's kind of weird to think of. Like, I feel like 2001 was sort of a void of a year. Like, I don't really remember what came out. Like, you have to remind me what happened in 2001, because as soon as you say 2001, I'm like 9/11. And you know, it's just, it was, you know, I wonder. It's weird to think that, like, you don't have to be much younger than us for that to not really be how you. I think I was about as young as you could be and still have it be that impactful of a memory of what happened in 2001, where I should otherwise remember because it was my freshman year of high school or sophomore year of high school. But that's besides the point.
You remember. No, what I think is interesting is, I mean, that was, yeah, the year they came out with the iPod, it was also a huge stock market crash, which I was reading or listening to something about that. And they were saying that one of the things that happened is that the government was pumping a ton of money into the tech industry for fear of Y2K and, you know, getting prepared for it and, you know, wanting to not have the world end on us.
Yeah.
And they said it happened, and so 2000 was done, and everything was A-okay. And so they stopped spending money to, you know, try to prepare for it, and that led to you know, less money going into the tech industry, which led to the stock market just tumbling on them. And, you know, and then, yeah, you add in a couple airplanes and the economy goes into a nosedive. But,
yeah,
interesting. So,
yeah.
I know what you mean, though. That is interesting. Speaking of really positive news, there is a story of a guy. Let's see if I can, in Ohio, who wore Google Glass to the theater. And
like I would do if I had Google Glass.
Yeah, well, don't do it. At least to an AMC theater. Because AMC's policy is that if they think that you are recording something, they're going to do something about it. And so apparently they called the MPAA to investigate it, yeah. And they ended up contacting Homeland Security, which oversees movie theft.
And which is weird to think about how that got under their purview, but yeah, continue.
Yeah, and he goes, this guy says, you know, movie theft is something that we take very seriously, and our theater managers contacted the MPAA anytime something's suspected, and so that's what they did. They said, well, we're huge fans of technology and innovation. Wearing a device that has the capability to record video is not appropriate at the movie theater. And at that weekend, a guest was questioned for possible movie theft after he was identified wearing a recording device during a film. And
So they
talked to him, and he said that he was searched, and more stuff was taken away from him, like his phone and his work computer and his wallet. And they said after an embarrassing 20 to 30 minutes outside the movie theater, he and his wife were conducted into two separate rooms in the management office at the mall, where the guy in the badge introduced himself again and showed me a different ID. And, you know, he says, eventually after a long time, somebody came up with a laptop and a USB cable, at which point he told me it was my last chance to come clean, that, you know, you're recording video. And he's like, no, I repeated it. And, He said there's nothing to come clean about. And so this you know, this guy connected Glass to his computer, downloaded all of his personal photos and all of his stuff, started going through it. And then they said, like, it was after an hour. Well, they said after an hour of all of this and finally that 5 minutes of going through stuff, they went, okay, well, they concluded that they had done nothing wrong. So they gave him 4 free passes to another movie at AMC for his trouble. And then this guy was kind of ticked because they didn't really give him an apology. They just said, okay, you didn't do anything. Moving on.
Yeah, which, and well, and it's ridiculous because it's
I love America. America.
So did they illegally detain anybody who was wearing a Galaxy Gear watch as well? Because that has a recording device that there you can wear. Or, you know, anybody
not
that,
yet.
I don't know, just had a smartphone. Yeah, that, you know, the problem there is nobody has one. Or you know, anybody who has, I don't know, a smartphone. Jeez Louise. It's just so ridiculous. Like, I mean, I get it. That whole situation is just frustrating, though, because it's like, yeah, that one's such a bigger issue. I mean, and it's like, it's funny. The chick who was wearing Google Glass on the road, she got a ticket. That ticket got dismissed because they couldn't prove it was on. If you can't prove it was on, whatever, it's done. So they didn't even, you know, nothing happened there. Thankfully, but you know, the fact that she got the ticket was like, you know, oh, what the heck is going on here? And I don't know. I just we're gonna have to figure this out because these are coming. You can't, you know, you cannot say no, especially because it's like, I, you know, to me, like, yeah, I don't think you should be able to watch movies on your, you know, heads-up display while you're driving down the road. But the idea that a heads-up display can't be used to make you safer is incredible. I mean, it's just ridiculous. No, you can definitely, I think we'll get to the point relatively quickly that, you know, different alerts and stuff about traffic and what's going on that will be in your face so you don't have to take your quote-unquote your eyes off the road, but it'll also augment you so you're safer. You know, I sit there and I go, like, that obviously is coming. It'll come quickly in the next couple of years. And are we going to say you can't use any heads-up display technology because the human brain is infallible? No. It's crazy. It's, like, literally the most dangerous thing we can possibly do any day of the week is drive a car. We kill more – that's how most of us die, like, you know, outside of old age at the end of it all. You know, accidental deaths are – vast majority are car-related things. It's incredible how many people die. So if we could do anything to make it safer, you'd think we'd jump all over that. But, you know, no, the tendency right now is no. Don't use technology, even if it can make you safer. You know, I don't know. It's just – this is going to get complicated fast, and we're going to have to figure it out. And I just keep hoping and praying that it's not a bunch of old people who don't have any idea how this stuff works that are going to be making these court decisions. Is they're not able to, I don't think.
So, I think this might. No, we got a couple more. So this next one, we'll flip it back to the good side of life. There was this guy. His name is Chris McKinley. He was a mathematician getting his PhD, doing some big data stuff. And he was lonely. Mm-hmm. He was lonely and wanted a girlfriend.
He was getting his PhD in big data stuff. Sounds like a dork, man. Yeah, go for it.
Actually, sounded like he had a pretty cool life. What did he do? I can't. They had it. Let's see. He was raised in Boston. He graduated college in 2001 with a degree in Chinese. And then in August of that year, speaking of 2001, he took a job part-time in New York translating Chinese into English for a company on the 91st floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center.
Oh, wow.
And towers fell 5 weeks later, but he didn't have to go into the office until 2 o'clock that day. And so he was asleep when the first plane hit. And they said, and after that, I asked myself what I really wanted to be doing. And so he was, you're going to love this. A friend at Columbia recruited him into an offshoot of MIT's famed professional blackjack team, And he spent the next few years bouncing between New York and Las Vegas, counting cards and earning up to $60,000 a year. That experience kindled his interest in applied math, ultimately inspiring him to earn a master's and then a PhD in the field. So,
so what you're trying to say is he was incredibly smart. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
The MIT and Blackjack team is one of the most incredible stories. I still can't believe they ruined it as bad as they did with the movie, but whatever.
Yeah. It's Hollywood. So anyways, this guy is getting his degree. A little lonely. And so he was on different dating websites, as they do, and because he was using the computer like 3 in the morning, because that's the optimal time to run this supercomputer, essentially. And he was just totally frustrated with the process, and he's like, dude, you're not – he's like, this isn't working. And the way that OkCupid works is that they have you respond to a random pool or to 350 questions, okay? You know, stuff like which of the following is most likely to draw you to a movie – and then they would ask, you know, how important is God/religion to your life? And then for each of those answers, they give you responses. You also have to rate how important that question is on a 5-point scale. You know, it's irrelevant or mandatory. You know what I mean? Okay. And then what they do is they will then match you with other people who have done it. But the closest you can get, you know, with 100% being like an absolute perfect match. And he was doing some math, and he's like, he was in LA, and he's like, and it's got like something like 200 million women in LA. Approximately 80,000 of them are on OkCupid, and he had like less than 100 girls, who females, I guess, who were even above that 90% compatibility mark, and he's like, that's a really bad, you know, ratio. So you think I should have more. And so what he started doing some research and started learning more about it. And what he learned is that they only do the matching where you and that other person have answered the same questions. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So, so, you know, if you, how do I say it? So like, you know, if you've answered 350 questions and some other girl has answered 350 questions, but you've only overlapped on like 50 of them because they have like, you know, thousands of questions that they can ask. Yeah. They don't ask everyone the same 350 for some reason. I don't know why, but whatever. You know, if there's only an overlap of 50, it's like impossible to get 100% or higher than that, essentially. Okay?
Okay.
So this guy being a big data guy went, you know what? I think I can do better. I think I can do better. Yeah. And so so what he did was he wrote, again, super smart guy, he wrote a bot, essentially, a script to create a bunch of fake profiles and fill out these, you know, surveys, just randomly 350 questions. And he goes, I didn't really care about the responses. I wasn't using these for dating. I just wanted to know what the questions were. All right? Because he said the problem was, you know, so he was like, his thing was, if I could figure out the questions that these other girls are asking or answering, then I can answer those questions and I'll answer them truthfully, but then I'll have more potential to match, you know? So he was like, so he goes, he identifies that his problem is that the 350 questions that he asked are not the same ones that these other girls are asking.
Right.
But the only way he knows what questions they answer is if it'll tell him, you answered this and you answered this and she answered this. You know what I mean? So the only way he would know what they answered was by the ones that he answered. So anyways, so he wrote this algorithm to create profiles to start to answer the questions so that he could you know, figure out what they were, and then it would show the automatic match. And so he started out with 12 fake accounts and eventually ended up with a few hundred. So he said after 3 weeks, he had harvested 6 million questions and answers from 20,000 women all over the country.
Wow.
Okay. And he had this thing running just 24 hours a day and stuff like that. And so then what he had to do was he had to find a pattern in the survey data, you know, a way to roughly group the women according to their similarities. Because he was like, I don't necessarily care about all women. I care about the women I'm interested in. I want to match with them. And so he said, like, he had this breakthrough when he used a modified Bell Labs algorithm called K-Modes. It was first used in 1998 to analyze diseased soybean crops. And it takes categorical data and clumps it like colored wax swimming in a lava lamp. And you're like, what? Okay, yeah. Crazy. So anyway, so he
I did it. The guy is smart.
20,000 race. Yeah, yeah. So he did it. He applied that to these 20,001 women, and he was eventually able to tune it so that he created 7 statistically distinct clusters based on the questions and answers. And then what he did is he did it again. He retasked his robots to gather another sample of 5,000 women in L.A. and San Francisco, and it was still statistically significant. He was like, all right, sweet. I got something that's real here. He's like, yeah, it's a math guy. You got to make sure you know, check our math here.
Yeah, that's
and
cool,
so,
man.
And then what he did is he looked at each cluster, and he was like, you know, one of them was too young, a couple of them were too old, and then it was too Christian. And then there were two others where he was like, there's one where there were women in their mid-20s who looked like indie types, musicians, artists, and then there was the golden cluster, you know, and, you know, where he was like, you know, they were a little older, they had, you know, professional jobs, and, you know, he's like, all right, we'll figure it out. And so he's like, okay. So then he looked at those groups and then said, okay, what are, you know, just started doing some, you know, some averages. What are the 350 questions that they tend to answer most of the time? You know,
right?
And then he did that separately for each group. And then what he did is he wasn't sure which group he liked, and so then he set up 2 profiles, and you know, one of which was targeted for the one group, one of which was targeted for the other group, and went through and answered those 350 questions. And he goes, now I answered them, you know, honestly, because I genuinely wanted to find someone who was a match for me. And, you know, so he's like, so I did some of that. But then he also let the computer algorithmically decide how important the question was. So, like, he goes, I get the honest answer, but then I let the computer tell me how important, you know, is this a mandatory thing or just, you know, semi-important, that kind of stuff. You're just like, what? Oh, just totally goofy. And then what he said he did was he said that if you view their profile, you then they will get a message saying that you viewed their profile,
right?
Essentially, okay. Right. And so he goes. So I set up another bot that would. Oh, so he said he did the matching thing, right? And you know, he filled it out,
yeah.
And he said that how many were there? 10,000 women that were over the 90% match. Okay, so we went from like less than 100 to 10,000, right? He's like, oh, right, yeah. And so we're like, now I just need to get noticed. So again, he wrote this this algorithm that would just visit the page, and then they would get their notice that he had visited, and you know, and then they would reciprocate. So he's like, yeah. So I was getting like 400 messages a day from women. Saying, oh yeah, you're just like, what? Crazy. Then he was like, yeah, he's like, and then he goes, but here what really you know, what really got him going was he was like, now I had to do more research. I had to start meeting these women to see how how the algorithm worked, you know. and so he kept like these meticulous notes of each date. And like for one of the groups, he noticed, like, he started to notice some trends, I guess. Like, for example, in the younger cluster, the women, they invariably had 2 or more tattoos, and they lived on the east side of LA. And then in the other, there was a disproportionate number who owned mid-sized dogs that they adored. It's like, just kind of weird.
I love how it's like, one of those is like a legitimate, like, you know, or not, it's not even a legitimate, but it's just like a, it's a, you know, where do you live? Like, what kind of a lifestyle questions, you know, do you have tattoos? The other one is, but the last data point is no. Those are just random trends. He wasn't trying to sort out what type of women they were, like, you know, what communities grew up. But no, they were just interesting trends that I noticed. Like, that's funny. This guy, you know what? It's funny. At first I felt bad calling him a dork, but I'm coming back around. Now this guy's a dork. Like, he's really smart.
Yeah, super smart. Probably onto
something, but... Oh, man. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then it says, you know, after about a month of dating, equally from both profiles, he decided that he was spending too much time on the freeway, reaching East Side women from the tattoo cluster. And so he deleted that profile and was like, all right, I'm done. It was like, and so his efficiency improved. But, like, he's like, he would go on multiple dates a day and had, and he had a system set up, right, that he was, you know, trying to, and so it was like, I guess in his notebook, he had one example where, like, he took two girls to the same beach at, you know, two different hours in the day. And, you know, he's like, you got to do that. And so he was like, he had been on more than 55 dates, you know, in just a couple months. And he was trying to figure it out. But yeah, at the same time, he was like, man, I just wasn't finding them. And then came Christine Tane Wang, a 28-year-old artist and prison abolition activist. And, and I guess McKinley had popped up on her search for 6-foot guys with blue eyes near UCLA, where she was pursuing her master's in fine arts, and they were a 91% match. And so he met her at the Sculpture Garden on campus. From there, they walked to a college sushi joint, and he felt it immediately. And what was super funny about it was and she was the 88th person that he had dated. from his little thing. And I think where was the, I forget where it was, but she essentially, like, I should have just kept reading. He felt it immediately. They talked about books, art, and music. When she confessed that she had actually made some tweaks to her profile before messaging him, so that he would be, you know, more attracted to what he saw her doing. Hmm. And he goes, yeah, about that.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny as I sit there and I try to empathize with him. I try to put myself in his shoes. I think that is a really interesting thing, that a mind trick that he played on himself. Because when I sit there and I, you know, you got this guy that's like, obviously he's incredibly smart, and he's living a really, really, really cool lifestyle. He's traveling back and forth, you know, to the coast, spending a lot of time at Vegas, you know, and when you watch the movie, like, Black 20 with 21, right? You know, they make it super glamorous and party style, but when you really learn about the blackjack team, a few of them really got into the, wow, we're living a super swanky lifestyle of partying all the time. But most of them were just dorky math nerds that were making crazy money. And I could totally see this guy sitting there, like, you know, going through the dating process and never having really any success. So he tries what he sees as a scientific way to kind of facilitate it, make it easier, and a data-driven way, something that he's comfortable with. We're going to look at this as an experiment. It's been built up, and he went through and he, you know, used that. And when he realized that tool was completely insufficient for what he wanted, he then took the tool and extrapolated even more data from it, turned it into his own device. And what I love most about this story is the fact that he didn't start, he didn't realize that he had gotten all the connections that he wanted, and he had this preponderance of dates. But I still am like envisioning this guy, and I got a feeling that if you met him, I'd be right about this. But as a guy that would just have a really hard time asking a girl out and going out on a date with her, you know, like randomly meeting up with her. So he didn't make it about dating them. He made it about collecting more data. Because it's effectively, and that's what he looked at it as, because I wonder if he did that to himself on purpose, where if like he talked about it with somebody and he was just like, I got all these like connections, but I'm like scared. And they said, don't make it about the dates, or if it was just something that like he instinctively did,
probably that more likely.
He just wanted more data, but that's effectively what he did, is he went on all these dates and he made it, he gave himself courage, because it didn't matter if it was successful or not. It didn't matter if he hit it off with the girl or not. He's got plenty of other chances, and really and truly, he just wants more data. You know, and the real question is, when he finally met this girl and he went on like the third date and he realized, oh, I can't go on any more dates, did that bum him out or did that excite him? Was the search finally over? Or was he now, did all of his data dry up? Because if it's the latter, he's a true dork. If it's the former, he's a true genius. Like, just dealing with him, you know, with who he is. That's a fascinating story. That's like,
yeah, it was interesting. You know,
yeah, where technology meets humanities. That's
well,
cool.
And I love, I mean, and they make the point where, you know, he's like, look, it's not like, you know, he hacked it and got an awesome match. And he goes, and therefore we have a great relationship. He goes, no, it was just a mechanism, you know, a hacking that helped them put them in the same room together. And he goes, right. And I was able to use OkCupid to find someone. To which, it's funny, because she bristles and goes, you didn't find me, I found you. Which was true. He goes, yeah, I guess you were right, huh? So, yeah. Anyways, they are currently engaged, and they don't have a wedding date set yet because there's a lot more research to be done to find that optimal wedding day. And just like, haha. But yeah, just kind of a fun story of, you know, math geek hacking some technology to make it work. And he did say that when he first started the profile, you know, and do all the bot stuff, they actually did get his 12 ones that he started out with actually got kicked off because OkCupid was able to detect it, that they were bots. And so then he had a friend of his agree to let him install some software on his computer to track. He wrote a program that allowed him to track his typing and his clicking speeds. And so then he was able to slow his bots down to mimic his friend's true speed. And then he just had a computer just running so that OkCupid couldn't determine that they were bots because they genuinely acted the way a human acted.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, I was just like, oh, jeez. And how do you describe that in a profile?
Yeah.
Pretty funny.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, pretty. I read that, was like, oh man, wish that was me.
That's a cool story. That is a cool story.
Yeah.
You know what? These other two, they're not as good. I don't even. There's no reason to end on them. We can end it there.
All right. Love it. We end on love and hacking. Hacking love. Yeah, it was good. Yeah, that was awesome. Hey, it's good to be back. Feels good.
Yeah, definitely.
Feels good. Yeah, everybody, thank you for joining us. My name is James Furlow. I forget. You're a decaffeinated. That's right.
Yeah.
You are a decaffeinated. So my decaffeinated brother is Matthew Furlow. And so we will talk next time. Thank you.